accession number 20970REAL8.
Right.
We arrived finally in the border town of Sopron, and there was a curfew. Curfew in those countries mean that if you are seen, you move about, they shoot first and ask questions later. We had never been in this city before, but we had a name and an address on the letter that my uncle had, my aunt's husband had written. Who can we ask? There was a policeman. So you go up to a policeman. I don't know whether you can envisage the enormity of the action, going up to a policeman, the only person who was able to be there. And so we say, we are looking for this street. You are looking for this street? Don't you know there is a curfew on? We are looking for a Dr. Lebovich. Dr. Lebovich, oh, he's a darling. He brought my children to this way. He even brought me to this way. Let me show you. That is his house. Well, apparently this was a saintly local doctor whom even the local population admired and revered. So we go upstairs in this small house and ring on the bell. And it's nearly midnight. Elderly people, he and his wife, both suffering from a heart condition, as it turns out. They opened the door to a tiny little slot and slam it immediately. Alien people, they don't open. So we slide the letter underneath. They open the door again and they expect to see Jewish-looking people. After all, we are to be the family of his university colleague, another Jewish doctor. And he sees two people who don't look particularly Jewish. There followed then a long negotiation through the open door while we tried to convince him, no, we didn't kill someone or knock them down or rob them of this letter, that we are legitimate. He asked questions through the door to try to establish that we are truly the people we say we are. So finally they let us in. They made us welcome. They acted like our own parents would have done. They looked after us, and they found for us a Schwab peasant. Now, in earlier centuries, there was an influx of Schwab people to the borderlands between Austria and Hungary. They came from Schwaben, which is, in fact, the German region. These people maintained their language and still do, many of them. They speak broken Hungarian and they speak German otherwise. And they know the country as the back of their hand. And here was this Schwab peasant who, like others, was grateful to Dr. Lebovich, because that was the kind of man he was, and he was going to help us over the border, and any money that needed to change hands, we had some money because my parents provided what they could. Otherwise, Dr. Lebovich was going to give them money, and we were set to go on a certain date. I think it was the 2nd of December. That was 2 or 3 days ahead. Why we had to wait, I really don't know, but there were some strategic reasons that the Russian peasant, the Schwab peasant, felt this was the most, the least chancy day. On the night when we were to start, two things happened. The snow came down, which was bad news because that shows the tracks as you walk along. And a family turned up on the doorstep, friends of the doctors. The group comprised young father, an 8 months pregnant young mother, a baby son of two, and a blind grandmother. And the day came for the same reason as we. They wanted the doctor's help to get across the border. So the doctor said, this is wonderful, because you are going to be able to help this family. So instead of the whole walk across the border taking 2 hours of two fit young people like John and me, it took something like 5 or 6 hours because the baby was given a sedative which instead of putting him to sleep made him scream because he felt sick. The grandmother was stumbling on the barbed wire and in the we had to walk through exploded minefields between the two countries and so on. It was a difficult journey. I carried the suitcase, my husband carried the baby, the young father carried the blind grandmother, or at least a letter by, and so on. Finally, we arrived on the other side in a border village. Not before a big fright, I thought I saw a Russian tank. It turns out it wasn't a Russian tank, it was an enormous bush. But your nerves were by then shot. The Russian, Shwab peasant got drunk way before the time because he was frightened. He prepared himself for the short trip and instead there was this. So he abandoned us after a while and said, look at that light, follow that light and keep going in that direction. And when we woke up in the morning, we found the place where we finally found shelter where the light shone was the changing rooms of the local football clubs. This was on one side of the football pitch. On the other side was the Russian watchtower. We were not very far from the place of danger. We didn't even realize how near we were. In the night came various people, some of whom had lost their companions because they were shot into the Lake Ferto, which was nearby. There was somebody who came with severe hypothermia because he was spotted in the reeds of the lake. The lake was frozen, of course, it was winter time by then. And whenever he tried to move out from the reeds, the people were shooting at him because they knew he was there. So he was sheltering inside the lake for several days, 2 days, I think, in the frozen waters. It was fraught, but a large number of people came. It's a wonderful meal. They gave us a cup of lemon tea with cheese sandwich. It just shows you it's not so much the meal, it's the occasion. We had some kind of possessions originally, but we had to abandon them because carrying the baby clothing and carrying members of the family, or supporting them, was the priority. So when we arrived, we had literally nothing other than what we stood up in. It's a good way to say it, but I don't think many people have the experience. In fact, I had less because my own coat got torn in the barbed wires. So I had a coat torn to shreds in which to stand up, and no change of underwear, nothing, absolutely nothing. When I washed our underwear, we had to stay indoors until they dried. In Vienna, there were some shelters provided, but there was a loudhailer saying that the city is overfull, that they are afraid of epidemics, and whoever was able-bodied and capable of moving should go to the railway station and take the first train out and leave. We were public-spirited. We took the first train out without even looking where it went and we arrived in Paris. My father had a long-lost sister and her well-to-do family who lived in Paris. And my father's sister, who was well-meaning but poor, and never learned the French language, and was all her life a refugee in France, thought that it was a good idea to free us from this camp and take us to her home. But her home was both a home and a workshop, Her husband was a little tailor and they were trying to eke out a living. Her children, who were very well-to-do and very French, hadn't any great interest in us. My cousin, owner of many impressionist paintings and a thoroughly rich man, gave us £5 worth of French money, and with that he had done his duty. And then we discovered that we had lost our refugee status, because as soon as we were out of the camps, the refugee camp, the authorities washed their hands off us. They had enough trouble clearing some of the 100-something thousand people from Vienna. So they were pleased to be rid of us. We wanted to come to this country. We always had. We went to the British Embassy, but they said, thank you very much, you're not interested. We have to clear Vienna. And you could understand their point of view. But there we were. We were suddenly finding ourselves on the streets of Paris, because we felt we mustn't impose on these poor old people, my aunt and her husband. Finally, after a lot of trouble, we persuaded, we wrote hundreds of letters applying to for jobs in England, and everybody said, come and be interviewed. I mean, this was catch 22. We couldn't come to be interviewed. But finally, one of the major electronics companies was sending a representative anyway to Paris. He interviewed us, gave us a meal, and gave us a job. By then we have accumulated £56 of debt. The person who lent it to me wasn't my rich cousin and wasn't my poor little auntie, but a crippled ex-footballer, a total stranger, whose acquaintance we made by chance, who was kindly and knew trouble when he saw it. So he sent us £56, which we paid back by degrees in due course. So we found ourselves finally in England. It all started with a misunderstanding. We landed in Cambridge, in the home of a don who already had one or two tiny sons and a new baby. And his wife wanted an au pair and was willing to put up with a refugee au pair woman's husband as well. Little did she realize that what she got was a recently qualified professional woman with ambitions to do some work. And I had a job no less than my husband, as perhaps I might not have been allowed into the country. So it took us a little while to understand that she expected somebody else and I expected something else too. I expected that we shall have shelter in somebody's house who might have a room to rent, and she wanted help. So we tried to find accommodation. If anybody has tried to find accommodation midterm in Cambridge, they will know it's not easy. But we did finally, by some kind of trickery. But in the meantime, I did what I could after working hours, trying to help the Don's wife with the household chores. My degree was in electrical electronic engineering. I was proud of it. It was, as I say, with not only with first-class honours, but with some special prize for good performance. And it was quite interesting that one of the first jobs that Don's wife gave me to do was to iron baby clothes. So she said to me, here, look, this is an electric iron. You don't have to put charcoals into it, nor do you put it on the gas to warm it up. You need only to put it by this piece of thing. It's not a string, it's a wire. You put it in the wall, you plug it in, and it gets warm. Does it indeed, said I. This just measures or gives you a feeling of the extent of the dislocation between well-meaning British people and the other people whom they took into their homes. She didn't mean to insult me, but she was not interested in me. She was not interested in the Hungarian Revolution. She was not interested in anything. She wanted a nanny, an au pair. The situation in the Don's house, I mean, they were not unkind, but the situation in that house was intolerable. We could have afforded to live somewhere, but we couldn't find anywhere to live. And I remember one, I was the one that spoke English. My husband read the technical literature, but he was tongue-tied. And on one occasion, having gone through a number of advertised vacant rooms, none of them were available by the time I got there, I was going back to work along a long, long street leading out of the city of Cambridge, Chesterton Road. And the houses were like each other. And I had this feeling of unreality, that here are all these houses, and all these houses have inhabitants, and all the inhabitants of the city have homes, but we have no homes at all. There must be somewhere amongst these, there must be a room, an empty room. So let me try to pick out a house, and let me ring the bell to see whether there is an empty room. How do I choose? They are all alike, terraced houses. Ah, there was one which didn't have a television aerial. That was a distinguishing feature. I went up to the door, and I said to the elderly, very old lady, excuse me, I heard that you had a room to rent. Total lie. And she said, no, no, you made a mistake. I haven't any rooms to rent. And then, as I was sadly turning around, thank you very much, goodbye, she called after me, and she said, well, I don't know why. We could do with a little extra money, and since our children got married, these rooms have been standing there. Why don't I rent it to you? Why don't you indeed? Well, that was our great relationship. The lady said in 3 days' time the rooms will be ready, and she made a little kitchen out of a box room for me, and a living room out of a spare bedroom for us, and when she baked a cake or a piece of bread. When I got home from work, there was the scent of newly baked food in my room, and she was kind. Once I embarrassed her because we were invited out to my boss's house, and I said to her, Mrs. Easton, could we have a key so that we don't disturb you, we might come home late. And she said, I'm very sorry, my husband goes out tonight, Saturday night, he goes to the pub, and he has the door key, I can't let you have a key. Oh, well, in that case, perhaps we shall not go, because we don't want to disturb you coming in late. And she said, why don't you use the kitchen door? So I said, may I have a key to the kitchen door? Well, we never had a key to the kitchen door. Those were the times. And she had lived in the house for 40 years, never had a key to the kitchen door. We had difficulties to leave Cambridge because the local employer took advantage of the fact, quite deliberately, that the city was beautiful and it was desirable to its graduates. They paid very little and gave very little opportunity for advancement. The jobs we had were wonderful to start with, but it was clear to us that we should do something more and something else. But we had a labour permit only to work in this particular place, and we needed formally to be released. They had to sign some papers to say, yes, we can now move to another employment. We were interviewed and given a job in a different, in a larger provincial city. It was a good choice, a good job. The head of the laboratory interviewed us. He had difficulties to cut through some of the paperwork in his own factory, and finally exerted a great deal of professional and industrial pressure. He became a friend until he died, and his children are friends of ours to this day. And finally we moved. But even then, I had to go and remonstrate at the Home Office to try to negotiate that we should be released from one employment and take on another. The position of a refugee, even if very well qualified, and I must tell you this, the communist regime had many things in its disfavor, and nobody knows it better than I. But in its favor is an extremely well-developed education system, which sustained the university graduates, the engineering graduates even, notwithstanding the poor equipment park. Engineers should be well-equipped in their courses. We were not. But so rigorous, so thorough was our theoretical education that we were well prepared to work in the West and absorb the relative ephemera of the equipment which changes as technology developed and build our career on the firm foundations of mathematics and the sciences and rigorous theory. The education system was good. The education system allowed those that were lucky enough to be in my generation, later on they couldn't, but I could learn English, and I had good English, not conversational English, and they chose things wrongly. I mean, we were brought up on Thomas More's Utopia and the Canterbury Tales and things, not exactly the right fare for foreign students to learn their language for the first time. Nevertheless, I had good English, and we had a good profession, and there was at that time great need for professionals like we. And nevertheless, we were totally unprepared for life in the West. We didn't understand the system. We did not know what was expected of us. They didn't know what to expect from us. As a research engineer in a laboratory, for example, I was leaned upon repeatedly, first very kindly and later on quite fiercely by my colleagues, to take tea breaks. The notion of a tea break was totally unknown to me. They wanted their tea breaks, and they could see that their rights as workers were eroded if somebody works through the nominally agreed tea break. So they said, come and have tea with us. No, thank you, said I. Well, that was not the end of the matter. There were various other similar things. The head of the laboratory, who was later to be our friend, felt that our qualifications should be formally recognized by the professional institutions of this land. I never saw any letters after people's name. That was no custom. I never understood what these meant. He introduced me, sponsored me, whatever. I immediately became graduate member of my professional institution, no hassle. My husband had difficulty, though, because he was above the critical age of 27, and to be a full chartered engineer member required recognizing the university's education system in detail. So he became the test case. Thereafter, anybody mentions the name of the university, immediately people bow their heads in respect, because such is the institution by now. Many Nobel laureates in this country and elsewhere were sprung from that institution, but nobody knew before my husband's test case. It took 2 years. We had to track down professors who fled to the West, colleagues who worked in America, university professors who stayed behind but were frightened. My mother was sitting at the dean of my faculty, who, when he gave me my degree, congratulated me, and at any time throughout my career, if I needed any help, any reference, all I needed to know to do is mention his name or go to appeal to him. My mother and father sat in his office for days before gaining admission, and he was wringing his hands, and he said he cannot ruin his career by signing a piece of paper to testify that I had been his student. So this, I mean, my own records amounted to very little. That was of no consequence. Like I said, I needed only graduate membership, but my husband's was a big deal. And relentlessly, our friend, the head of the laboratory, pressed us. He said we should buy a house. I mean, this nothing sounded more absurd to us. Buy a house? We never owned a square foot of space which we could call our own. We didn't have a room before. He wants us to buy a house. He tried in vain to explain to us that that is the system in this country. And I never understood any of the procedure that he took in his hand and arranged for us. He got us 90% mortgage out of for newly built houses and guaranteed on behalf of the company the remaining 10%, and there we were suddenly in a totally empty new house in the dead of winter of 1957 in a northern provincial city without a stick of furniture, without a piece of wood to burn in the fireplace, without a cooker, without anything, but we were owners of this house. And we were uncomprehending. It was interesting. We went to the greengrocer locally and we asked for orange boxes to spare, and he thought we were crazy, but those were our cupboards and bedside tables. We bought a cooker which came with a baking pan, and in that we boiled soup. I don't think people realize the meaning of owning nothing in the way we experienced it. I remember my father writing when I resigned. My salary was as a graduate, as a research engineer, £500 a year, and it was an incredible fortune. And I wrote to my father, "This is my salary," and we bought John a pair of pyjamas. The pair of pyjamas. And the pair of pyjamas cost £2 or something. And my father wrote back, "What are you going to do with 250 pairs of pyjamas by the end of the year?" The enormity of the buying power of £500 hit us. We went to Cullen's. We didn't realize that there were cheap shops and dear shops. In Cambridge, there weren't cheap shops and dear shops. There were dear shops and dearer shops. Well, we went to Cullen's and we sent food parcels to Hungary to my parents and John's parents, and tea and coffee and dried fruits. They had never seen the likes of these, or they had, but that was before the war once upon a time. Suddenly, we were so incredibly rich, and yet we possessed nothing. When we hung up, we bought sub sheets for the beds. And we also bought, trying to be provident, some pink sheets, which we could hang up in the window with drawing pins to pretend they are curtains. But later on, we could use them in the beds. The neighbors came, because this was a smart housing estate. And what are we doing, having bed clothes hanging in the windows? It was hard to get accustomed to everything. It got better when my daughter was born. This was great. I always wanted, longed for children, but we felt that we could not have children in the other regime. And here we suddenly could. And my employer, who became our friend later, said it was unseemly. He was so enlightened, but those were a different time. That was a different age. This was 1959. It was unseemly for a pregnant woman to work in the laboratories beyond the time of about 4 months pregnant. I was very slim, and I was extremely well. It was not really difficult for me, but I was told I was not to work any longer. Now that meant not having any salary. There was, you know, we were reduced suddenly to one salary. Well, all right, this didn't matter. My parents appeared in the meantime. They left their country, their home behind and joined us. They could leave the country legally.